From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the September 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month, in our historic anniversary-based series It Happened Here, we're looking at a paper-based act of daring which changed the course of history. 75 years ago, the Prime Minister Winston Churchill visited Bletchley Park amid the utmost secrecy. He understood very well how important the intelligence being produced was, and he valued it highly. By all accounts, he gave a morale-boosting speech to the Codebreakers and left everyone feeling appropriately bucked up. We hear from Sir Arthur Bonsall, who got the surprise of his young life on his way to get lunch in the canteen that day. Once the initial euphoria of the VIP visit had worn off, though, a group of young men who were feeling the weight of the task on their shoulders cooked up a plan to try to channel Churchill's enthusiasm for the successes of Bletchley Park to help them overcome certain administrative and fiscal issues they were facing on the front line of code-breaking. The letter, signed by Alan Turing, Gordon Welchman, Hugh Alexander and Stuart Milner Barry, ever so politely outlines the need for more staff and resources. One passage reads, "The trouble to our mind is that as we are a very small section with numerically trivial requirements, it is very difficult to bring home to the authorities finally responsible either the importance of what is done here or the urgent necessity of dealing promptly with our requests. In short, they were scuppered by the secrecy." Stuart Milner Barry of Hut 6 took a train and then a taxi to hand-deliver the letter to No. 10 Downing Street. It was then 40 years before he saw the memo it prompted Churchill to write the very next day. "Action this day. Make sure they have all they want on extreme priority, and report to me that this had been done." It's economical with words, but it's an incredibly potent message and completely unequivocal. The original memo from Churchill lives in the National Archive, and a copy is on display in the visitor centre at Bletchley Park, and it's potent stuff. Also this month, we fast forward 50 years to 1991, to the party that saved Bletchley Park. The very first reunion for veterans turned into a call to action, cunningly disguised as a farewell to a semi-derelict site that was about to be bulldozed to make way for houses, a supermarket and a petrol station. We've recently discovered 14 hours of audio recordings made that day that were feared lost, but were in fact safely stashed away in Bletchley Park's archive and digitised only recently. From next month, we'll bring you highlights of that wonderful audio. Here's a taste of what's in store.
Well, I knew Bletchley Park existed from before. When I was with the Diplomatic Service, I was at Hanslope Park, some 17 miles away. And Hanslope Park is a direct result of the wartime activities of Bletchley Park, because the intercept activity, especially the Abwehr German Secret Service traffic, was intercepted by all my colleagues who then worked in Hanslope Park. So after 1974, when the whole thing came open, they actually told me the stories of what was happening in there. And I got to know so many of them, and I became fascinated. Well, the other thing was this. When I joined the Diplomatic Service in 1960 up here, I didn't have a house. That we were living down in Essex, so I came up here to stay and try and buy a house. We were then using Hut 3, the intelligence hut, as our hostel. So I knew Hut 3, I knew the other huts, and of course, having heard the story from my colleagues in Hanslope Park, I could put the whole lot together. And I realised, in fact, this site had a story really worth telling. And that's how the whole thing started off. The alarm bell started ringing in early 1991 when there was a meeting of the Bletchley Council, or Milton Keynes Council, I forget now, and the decision in fact was taken there that Bletchley Park did not need to be saved. They could give planning permission for a housing estate, I think of 300 houses, a garage and a small superstore. Now I went to that meeting with my good colleague Peter Jarvis. Now Peter and I had known Peter for years. Whilst I was in the dip service, I used to come home, my wife and I and that, with a few bugs, and we used to go and see Peter and that, so we knew Peter very well. So I was got an idea. I said, well, you know, Peter and I went down to the meeting, and afterwards he said, well, that's it. There's nothing we can do. See, this was BT property. BT had got planning permission to demolish the site. It was a site, of course, it's a very valuable site. It's just by the side of the railway station. You can fall out of bed, into a train to London, back home again. No parking fees, nothing at all. So we knew it was going to be a bit of a hard one, that we appealed to their better nature. And I went home, and about 2 or 3 weeks later, I suddenly had an idea. So I suggested to my wife, if we could only get a farewell party here for all the wartime staff we would find, and we get all the media down here to get them to interview them and tell the story, maybe we could do something. I said, but the trouble is, I said, of course, I don't know anyone around here because I spent most of our lives overseas. So she said, well, why don't you ask Peter? He was a GP. He knew everyone for miles. So Rona and I invited ourselves down for tea with Peter and Sue Jarvis, and I discussed the thing with them, and they said, yes, what a good idea, to get a party going and to see if we can get the media in. And that's how the whole thing started there.
This conversation has been held between Mrs. Rosemary Terry and subsequently Davidson.
Yes, Davidson. I remember you.
Mrs. Lucian Edmonton.
And Rosamund Case I was in. And I'm now Mrs. Peter Twin. And Peter Twin is the only person present, I suspect, who was here right at the beginning, before war broke out, I think. He came straight from Oxford. So he's one of the oldest people. You really ought to talk to him. I don't know where he is.
He was one of the moving figures.
Well, he was, yes, he was.
Remember things, but
everybody else is dead, I think, that was with him here. There he is, with glasses, talking. He's pointing at
pointing
me.
Pointing at you.
So, I don't expect to say anything. Peter, do you want to say a few well-chosen words about who you are and why you are?
That's rather difficult.
But, words yeah,
I'm Peter Twin. I worked on the Enigma, and in fact, I am now the only living British cryptographer to have worked on the Enigma since before the war. There's another colleague of mine with whom I've just been talking to, who worked in GCCS, which is this organisation's original name. She worked in it in London in 1937 or 38. So we are really the oldest inhabitants, I'm sure. I worked with a lot of very famous people like Dilly Knox, Alan Turing. I left at the end of the war, but I didn't wish to make a life task of this. And I went into the civil service and then came out of the civil service. And this is a very remarkable occasion to me.
May I just ask one question about Turing?
Yes.
Only that I saw a play about him in London three or four years ago.
So did I. I thought a most remarkable play. I didn't think it would be possible to make a dramatic play out of what is really an intellectual kind of subject. But when I went there, I was absolutely amazed. I sat on the edge of my chair. The representation of Turing, and let me say, I worked in the same room with Turing for 18 months. I knew him very, very well indeed. I could almost see him on the stage. And the actor playing him was Derek Jacobi, who got him off to a tee. For example, Derek Jacobi quite often came to the front of the stage and stood like this with his arms loosely folded across his stomach. And I was introduced to Derek Jacobi after the play, and we were talking. I said, how did you know that was such a very personal attitude? He said, well, I had a couple of photographs of Alan Turing, and in both places he's standing like this, and I came to the conclusion that must have been a personal idiosyncrasy, which is quite true. The whole representation of his character was so close to the truth, it's eerie.
Yeah. How would you describe Turing then?
Well, I knew him very well. Have you read the book by, I can't remember his name, about Alan Turing? It's a very fine book. I did, in fact, review for the London Mathematical Society. In that I said he was a very remarkable man. He was a little shy, interested in almost everything, a very good friend, like so many great people, a little intolerant of idiots, but he was really very pleasant to work with, a great friend, but a mystery. He was, as you know, homosexual. Not that bothers me. I mean, he made advances to me, but I'm not particularly interested, but didn't make any difference to our subsequent relationship at all. No. He's a mathematician of the worldwide repute, and really laid the intellectual foundations of the whole computer business. Not a particularly practical man, but by no means an unpractical man. One of the things I think they got wrong in the play, everybody describes Alan Turing as having a stammer. Now, he didn't have a stammer. What, in fact, he did was his mind worked so fast that when he was asked an interesting question, he thought about three or four things he wanted to say at once. His voice started to rise and all would bumble together, and they all got, all the sentences got jammed up. But it wasn't a stammer. He didn't have a stammer.
He was a good friend. And did he have many friends here at Bletchley?
Well, not many friends.
So he was had a lot of difficulty in expressing his feelings. I mean, it was
yes, he did. Yes, he
to
did.
Be able to.
Yes, he did. He did have a lot of difficulty expressing his feelings. I wouldn't say myself he had a lot of intimate friends. I don't believe he did. What he had was a very large number of old acquaintances who held him in the most utmost respect.
Yes.
And you couldn't. I mean, it's been my fortune to know intimately three really major intellects in the mathematical field. And once you've met somebody like this, there's no mistaking it. And I'm a mathematician, but I mean, you talk to these chaps and you know they're 20 classes out of your league. And this is how Alan struck one. And so everybody had the most immense respect for him. I mean, one has to say that his sexual difficulties created this terrible tragedy. That wouldn't happen these days, because, I mean, he was pursued by the police for some, I don't know, approach he made to something. That's unthinkable now.
Absolutely.
Any visit to Bletchley Park can be a powerful and even a moving experience when you walk in the footsteps of people whose work changed the course of history and then kept it to themselves for at least three more decades. You can't help but feel a tingle down your spine. So imagine what it's like when your grandma or granddad was one of those extraordinary people. Geoffrey Welchman's grandfather was the head of Hut 6, Gordon Welchman, whose visionary work prefigured cloud computing. His memoirs were somewhat stifled by the security services because of the far-reaching impact his war work was still having on espionage. Geoffrey was over from the States, and it came as something of a shock to him to see just how well celebrated his granddad was. He was welcomed to Bletchley Park by podcast producer Mark Cotton.
I'm sat here with the grandson of Gordon Welchman, Geoffrey Welchman, I think this is your first visit ever to Bletchley Park, is it, Geoffrey?
Yes, it is, yeah. Never been here before.
So what are your memories of Gordon? I mean, because we've just been around a few bits of the park, and it's quite weird for you, isn't it?
It is. I've been trying to think of how to put it into words. It's kind of like going to a place you heard about first in childhood. So it's a bit like going to Oz or Peter Pan's, you know, whatever, that Skull Island or something. Bletchley has just been, you know, a part of my life because of my granddad, and something that I've learned more about over the years as information's become more readily available. And so it really is kind of, I don't know what the word is exactly.
There's a disconnect, isn't there, for you?
A bit, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because when we went into the exhibition, I mean, you were transfixed by his OBE, weren't you, that
yeah.
you last saw in his house?
Right, right. He showed it to me when I was probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 or something, in his house. And to think that that's now here in an exhibit about how important he was to Bletchley and, you know, getting it up and running and stuff. It's quite an experience, I'll say that.
And we went into his office. I mean, you got to see, you know, the conditions that he worked in. I think that was quite a surprise for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was kind of like being underground with a dim lamp. So I didn't realize how dark things were. I didn't realize they were surrounded by bomb, what do you call it?
Blast walls.
Blast walls, yeah, yeah. I sort of had pictured them, oddly enough, as just the freestanding wooden structures. So it didn't occur to me that, you know, there wouldn't be light coming in and that they're all sort of in this kind of dark place. And of course, now I've seen the documentary and my sister and my aunt were here. And so I'd actually seen the place on TV, but to be in it is again, it's real. A place that you've heard about for so many years. It's a little disorienting.
I know, it's been quite strange watching you today, because it has really affected you, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I can tell. I mean, he obviously meant a lot to you.
Oh, definitely. He was, as I mentioned, to me, sort of the quintessential English academic type. You know, at the age I knew him, a bit absent-minded, but, that's not quite the word. He just had that academic manner. But he was my grandfather, and he was interested in music I made, and he was enormously fond of music. He had an incredible record collection, and it's through him that I grew up listening to the Goons, because he recorded them on reel-to-reel tapes, which is a big deal to me.
Yeah.
Reel-to-reel, you know. Yeah, in the 50s. And he would make cassette copies for us to play. And so that became, you know, part of my upbringing. So he was an interested grandparent, and we saw him quite a lot. When I was younger, he really didn't talk about the war. And then after the Winterbottom book came out, The Ultra Secret, he was just so happy. He was so happy about that, because it let loose this sort of floodgate of responsibility, or I should say, it let loose the responsibility to hold this floodgate of information inside. I mean, you've probably heard from other people the story of just not talking about the war at all, so that he didn't absentmindedly, accidentally slip up and let something, you know, let something out.
Well, about the only recorded footage of him was a BBC series in the 70s, wasn't there? And he specifically says he was worried about talking about the war, because he didn't know at any point whether something that he would say would be something that the other person would have no idea about, because it was only something he'd learned through Ultra.
Right, because it was classified.
Yeah.
So that was just enormously freeing for him. And pretty soon he started to work on the book. And I think Jenny said in the documentary, it was just a happy time for him. He just seemed to really be having such a good time, both sort of recalling all of the details and sort of trying to check on certain details to make sure it was accurate. Mm. And I think it was around that time, maybe before the book came out, he showed me the OBE. I had started to learn a bit about Bletchley. Maybe I read The Ultra Secret at the time. And so, of course, I asked him about it, and I asked him about meeting Churchill and Alan Turing. Was he really as strange as they say and stuff? And he'd say, oh, yeah, well, you know, he was a guy. He was a little eccentric. He kept his, what was it, the famous story about keeping his mug.
Chained to the radio.
Yeah. He said, yeah, that was true. It was true. But, you know, we worked together, and he was brilliant.
So the letter, because it was signed by the four of them, but as it's been said quite often, it does really smack of Gordon, doesn't it, that letter? And that's the sort of thing that he would have done to, you know, just go straight to the top man. Do you think that's right?
Well, I'm convinced, you know, by the books and the documentary, that it was probably his undertaking, and that he got the others to agree and sign on. Might have consulted with them on what he was saying, but might not have too, because he was very self-possessed and very confident about his areas of interest and expertise. I mean, he worked for a top secret think tank in Massachusetts called MITRE, and he couldn't really talk about the kind of stuff he did, but he did talk about the subject of cryptanalysis and cryptography even then. So, you know, I'm a teenager trying to sort of grasp what he's talking about, but he was really concerned about the direction things were going, especially in the States. I mean, that was where we were, and that was his main concern. I think I learned about the letter before the book came out, and he talked about it. And, of course, when a person talks about something they've done, it seems very kind of, I don't want to say run-of-the-mill, but this is something I did. Yeah, we signed this letter and sent it to Churchill. I said, Churchill? Really? The Churchill? That kind of thing. And yeah, it was just something that needed to be done. And that's how it was presented, you know. It was something that needed to be done. We weren't getting the attention and the support we needed. And so I thought this would work, you know. So I knew of its importance, but in a way I didn't realize how big it was to the effort, you know, until sort of more material started to come out. And unfortunately, after he died, years go by and just more and more Bletchley information. And now it's kind of hard to conceive how pivotal it seems that that letter was to the place we're now sitting in.
You know? I mean, without doubt, because Joel Greenberg wrote the biography of your grandfather, and you know, he said in that book you could describe Gordon Welshman as the architect of Bletchley Park, because it was Gordon's ideas, really, that turned this place into a factory for code breaking, wasn't it? But for you, it's your granddad.
It's a member of
my family. From your family, and it's been so nice to be able to watch you going around today, because you just like, oh, this is all a bit strange.
It is a bit strange. And unfortunately, I may be colored by, you know, what came after the book, which was not a happy thing. The pressure from the NSA was telling, and it hit him hard. Mm. The pressure from the British government as well. It was affecting. So in retrospect, Bletchley is charged for me. You know, it was this enormously important part of his history and of his professional working life that ultimately led to, you know, a very negative period at the end of his life that, you know, his wife at the time, Teenie, was convinced that it killed him. You know, the pressure just was getting to him, and he was already not, you know, the healthiest fellow.
What we try to do here is celebrate what he did and celebrate that period of his life that was pivotal, really, for the outcome of World War II.
Yeah.
Because as the years have gone by, people have learnt more about Turing. But now I think we're getting to the stage where possibly Gordon's getting as well known as Turing now.
Yeah, and that's been really gratifying. And I'm very, you know, appreciative of Joel's book. Thought it was great. It was great to just read more detail about, you know, the person I knew and find out, oh, he was there then. And, oh, he went to America during the war more than once, I think. Mm-hmm. And was making these connections with different, you know, code breakers. And, yeah, I think Bletchley Park is amazing. It's amazing to be here. I think that the presentation's great and respectful and sort of educational, you know, in the best possible way. So it's terrific.
Well, it's been lovely to take you around today, Jeffrey.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Daring comes in different forms. In July's episode, we looked at pinches, which were incredibly brave operations on board ships and submarines in which intelligence treasures were stolen from the enemy and the protagonists didn't always survive. But there's a chutzpah to be admired in this tale too. In October 1941, Bletchley Park was breaking all sorts of crucial codes, but there was a problem. Resources were not flowing into this ramshackle collection of wooden huts, possibly because only an elite few were allowed to see the whole picture and therefore could understand how important it was. The young scholars at the top of the code-breaking tree felt their responsibility keenly and were inspired by a visit from the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. He came, he saw, he bucked up the troops. And then they decided to try to tap into his obvious enthusiasm for what they were achieving. I sat down with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to consider just how cheeky this letter from Hut 8 and Hut 6 was and the significance of its impact.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
So we're talking about the memo that changed the course of history and that was prompted by the letter that changed the course of history, if you want to put it in quite strong terms. And it all began when Winston Churchill, as Prime Minister, made a sort of VIP visit to buck up the troops. Now, David, myth and legend surrounds that visit. So what did actually happen that day, as far as we can be sure?
There's relatively few facts we can be completely certain about. The first is that he did visit on the 6th of September 1941. And we know he met a number of senior staff, Travis. He also met Gordon Welshman and some of the other sort of hut directors. The extent to which he was expecting to meet the ordinary workers, if you like, is questionable.
Well, they would have had quite a lot of people in place by then, and it was starting to really soar, wasn't it? And in terms of successes, that's why he'll have come, because they'd really had lots of important breakthroughs by then.
By that point, yes, he's become himself very familiar with the intelligence they're producing. And he clearly wanted to find out more about that for himself. It wouldn't have been possible to tell everyone he was coming for security reasons as much as anything else. And so I think to a lot of the rank and file, it was a complete surprise that he was there. And his presentations, one or more that he gave, were pretty much impromptu, because people turned up and went, oh, it's the Prime Minister, and he felt obliged to say something. I don't think it was planned in his schedule in any particular way.
We've heard lots about him standing on various things. So that's one of the sort of, it's just a good example of how a little detail about something, there's lots of different versions of it from different people, and nobody's lying. They're all just remembering it slightly differently. And that's what makes it so difficult to get accurate history, really. It's a good example of that, even though it's only what Churchill stood on when he came to visit and gave a speech.
One account suggests a tree stump. Anne Ross, who gave quite a lengthy description, said that he was outside the mansion and his bodyguards held him on top of an upturned dustbin.
Mm. That would be quite high up, wouldn't it?
It would be quite high up. John Herivel described a pile of builder's waste at the end of Hut 6. We have a rock that commemorates the event now. Perhaps a rock is more appropriate than an upturned dustbin, but a Churchill Memorial dustbin, I'm not sure it's quite the way to go. The question is whether everyone is just describing the same incident. He may well have stopped more than once.
Did he just visit the once throughout the war?
As far as I'm aware, he only visited the one time.
You were here when Churchill visited?
Oh, yes.
What can you remember about
that?
Well,
what I remember about that is that there was absolutely no publicity beforehand. In fact, it was probably the reverse of that. Anyway, I didn't know he was coming, nor did any other ordinary member of this place. And it was during my lunch break. I was then, I think, working in Block A. I would go for my lunch break, walking across, approaching this circular lawn from that direction. And as soon as I got inside the lawn, I noticed a group of, well, yes, young women clustered out here on the edge of the lawn. And as I came across it, I, to my astonishment, saw that they were listening to Churchill. I mean, the last thing I was expecting to encounter. And what had happened was he'd been visiting Hut 6 and Hut 8 and places like that earlier in the morning. A group of girls hadn't been spoken to by him. They were just juniors. He'd been dealing with the sort of the top circuit breakers and so on. And they had all said to each other, well, we're not all going to say goodbye to him. So they guessed he would leave before lunchtime. And they had spent their lunch break standing outside there in a group. Churchill came out of the front door. His car was parked just outside these windows, big Daimler, just outside these windows, with an ATS driver sitting in it, looking straight ahead, nowhere else. And he wasn't making an important speech. I mean, it was just an exhortation. Carry on the good work, you know, that kind of thing. And I just managed to catch the final words. And he then got down off the stone he was standing on the edge of the lawn there, straight into his car. And by the time his car reached the corner there, he was already reading documents from a big red box. I do know that he stood on the stone where that peasant one is. And my guess is, after an incident in the previous year, in 1940, he came in 1941, previous year, it was a sunny day in the summer of 40, and various people were standing around on this bit of grass, and a sports car suddenly shot across it. The young man got his foot jammed on the accelerator, rolled across, fortunately not hitting anybody or anything, but the management here immediately recognised the danger that you know, there always were likely to be people hanging around out there on the grass on a nice day. And this might happen again. So I can't remember now how many days, but my memory is they seem to have reacted very quickly to have found a source of suitable stones to put round the grass, right round it, so no car could get onto it. And my guess is that they suddenly thought of, there's some dry stone walls in the rock garden. They knocked them down and got the big stones out of the bottom, enough big stones, they say 30 or 40 stones, something like that. The gardeners got a wheelbarrow and they wheeled them and they put them around this thing. Within days, it couldn't happen again. It seemed to me that it'd be quite an idea to put a little memorial of this event in the form of a stone. So Julie and I, with the aid of the gardener here, were shown some possible stones which he had found in the...
Well, I think we looked at them while we were in the bottom of the lake, didn't we?
Yes, yes. Anyway, there were lots of stones in the bottom of the lake. And I think what happened at the end of the war, when the post office took over this place as a training establishment, they didn't want these great stones around the grass because it made it difficult to cut the grass up against a big stone. And the nearest place to dump them was in the lake.
His visit inspired Milner Barry, Turing, Welchman and Alexander to put their heads together for Hut 6 and Hut 8 and write this quite extraordinary letter. Tell us what was in it.
Well, it comes against a background of Gordon Welchman in particular trying to reorganise how the code-breaking was done and get more resources and generally get the whole of Bletchley Park onto a more organised footing. And so he'd been writing memos of varying types for, since he'd been there really, for the previous year or more. He was already campaigning with Travis, who was at that point kind of second in command to Denniston. Travis was in charge of a lot of the administrative organisational matters, and Gordon Welchman had successfully persuaded Travis earlier in the year, in sort of May, April, May time, to provide more bits and pieces for them, and more personnel in particular. And the letter, when you read it, the specific requests are for staff, for personnel.
It's very detailed, isn't
it? It's quite detailed.
It's not a general kind of, please, sir, can we have some more? It's actually very specific, isn't it?
It is. And I think what makes it possible for Churchill to go, absolutely, this must be done, is they make three very specific requests for about 20 additional staff in each case. And he could probably look at that and go, that's 60 people. We must have 60 people.
Yeah, for the effort, everything was being thrown.
So in a way, I think the interpretation that it changed the tone for everybody and everything from that point forward is more to do with Churchill's very firm response to the letter than maybe what they intended by the letter when they wrote it. Because, as I say, they make what are quite modest requests in relation to what subsequently happened to Bletchley Park. They asked for 60 more people. They actually got 3,000 or 4,000 more people. But I think when the powers that be saw Churchill's response, you know, give them everything they need and tell me that you've done it, that changed the tone of the conversation, if you like.
That letter was quite a cheeky move on the part of these four young chaps. Now, they were senior in the organisation, but they were young, and it was a very perhaps hierarchical organisation that was very structured because it was run by military people as well as civilians, sort of fitted around the military at that stage, from what I can understand. And the military is nothing if not structured and stricter, its hierarchy. So just how mindful of that were they likely to have been, and maybe felt nervous, do you think, of doing that? Or do you think they were just kind of quite cocky because they were young and hadn't thought you couldn't do things?
I think there was a certain amount of the arrogance of youth about it. They clearly realised the importance of what they were doing. And I think in the light of Churchill's visit, they got for the first time a sense of how personally he thought it was important. You know, one of the things you learn about Churchill is that he took secret intelligence very, very seriously, unlike other leaders. And so having had him come and visit them and express such a strong interest in what they were doing, it probably gave them a real sense that if they spoke directly to him, they would get a favourable hearing from him. as I say, it comes against a background of Gordon Welshman in particular writing memos to all and sundry about things that he felt needed to be changed. Stuart Millbarry, when he discussed the letter, he suggested that the idea was probably Welshman's, but even he thought he was going out on a bit of a limb with this one. So rather than just sign it himself, he went and got three of his mates to sign it as well, to, you know, spread the blame a little bit.
Yeah, just me. Look, all these people think it's rubbish as well.
And Millbarry describes how when he took the letter to Downing Street, he suspected that he was selected to take it because he was the youngest and, in his own words, the most readily expendable.
Oh, so, if he got the thunderbolt for doing this. It must have been a nerve-wracking journey for him. The tone of the letter is interesting to me. It's incredibly polite. Now, they have really stuck their necks out to write it and to ask for these resources. Modest though they are, and very specific though they are, they clearly didn't want to, in doing this, undermine Travis. So does that say something about their working relationship with him, their sense of their position?
I think Welshman had already established a good working relationship with Travis at that point, and felt that he was listening to what he wanted, but that at that point Travis is still number two in the organisation and Denniston was still in post. The events come against the background of a variety of other administrative problems, if you like, that arise around that time. Hut 3 was having all sorts of difficulty, internal difficulties, and one thing another, and Denniston is ultimately moved on in spring of 1942. In February 1942, he goes off to run the commercial section in Berkeley Street in London. And Travis steps up to be the head of Bletchley Park. And so I think these events sit within that context of a certain amount of administrative upheaval around Christmas 1941 time. So it's not an isolated event, if you like.
It might seem like a bit insubordinate, but actually it's set against a background of that kind of behind-the-scenes turmoil, where people really want to further the cause, if you like. And it's admirable that they wanted to go to the furthest edges and reaches of what they could possibly achieve and didn't just sit on their laurels. And it shows the spirit that everybody threw, certainly on that list, threw into the war effort and what it meant to them.
Dear Prime Minister, some weeks ago you paid us the honour of a visit and we believe that you regard our work as important. You will have seen that, thanks largely to the energy and foresight of Commander Travis, we've been well supplied with the bombs for the breaking of the German Enigma codes. We think, however, that you ought to know that this work is being held up, and in some cases is not being done at all, principally because we cannot get sufficient staff to deal with it. Our reason for writing to you direct is that for months we have done everything that we possibly can through the normal channels, and that we despair of any early improvement without your intervention. No doubt in the long run, these particular requirements will be met. But meanwhile, still more precious months will have been wasted, and as our needs are continually expanding, we see little hope of ever being adequately staffed. We realize that there is a tremendous demand for labor of all kinds and that its allocation is a matter of priorities. The trouble, to our mind, is that as we are a very small section with numerically trivial requirements, it is very difficult to bring home to the authorities finally responsible either the importance of what is done here or the urgent necessity of dealing promptly with our requests. At the same time, we find it hard to believe that it is really impossible to produce quickly the additional staff that we need, even if this meant interfering with the normal machinery of allocations.
In terms of the precise detail of what we know of the exchange, the letter that Welshman wrote, they make three requests on behalf of three different huts. In Hut 8, they need more administrative clerks. They ask for 20 untrained grade 3 women clerks for Hut 8. In Hut 7, they were concerned that the men working in the hut were going to be liable for conscription, so they wanted them turned into a reserved occupation so they couldn't be called away. And for Hut 6, for Gordon Welshman's hut, they wanted more typists, so another 20 typists. And then again, for Huts 6 and 8, they ask for a body of wrens. So it's mainly personnel that they're requesting, and quite small numbers of personnel.
We have written this letter entirely on our own initiative. We do not know who or what is responsible for our difficulties, and most emphatically, we do not want to be taken as criticizing Commander Travis, who has all along done his utmost to help us in every possible way. But if we are to do our job as well as it could and should be done, it is absolutely vital that our wants, small as they are, should be promptly attended to. We have felt that we should be failing in our duty if we did not draw your attention to the facts and to the effects which they are having and must continue to have on our work unless immediate action is taken. We are, sir, your obedient servants, Turing, Welchman, Alexander, Milner Barry.
Churchill's response was to write a note saying, make sure they have all they want on extreme priority. And he added crucially on that, and report to me that this has been done. So it's like, you know, do this today and let me know.
I'm going to check.
The action this day part is actually a sticker. It's a printed label. He had a series of labels on his desk, almost sort of the 1940s equivalent of a post-it.
So it's like when you put on an email, urgent.
Yes, it's a little tag that is glued on that says action this day, which is sort of presumably when things went back to his secretary, they were sorted out, you know. Action this day, action tomorrow, action next week. So that part of it is a kind of pro forma that he used for his correspondence.
They were lucky in a way that it clearly meant a lot to Churchill. Intelligence itself, he was very hot on it. He very much considered it an important weapon of war. And he wasn't typical in that as a leader at that time, was he?
Churchill is quite unusual in his interest in secret intelligence. Other leaders... Eisenhower, for example, has almost no experience of it before he becomes president, and everything he knows about intelligence he learns during the course of the Second World War. Churchill, on the other hand, was in the Admiralty in the First World War, would have been aware of Room 40 and all those activities previously, and he remains obsessed with intelligence through the 1930s. Even when he's just an MP, not a government minister, he still manages to persuade the powers that be to give him access to intelligence. And during the Second World War, he was massively keen on it. Once codes start getting broken at Bletchley, he asks for every intercept to be sent to him every day, which, of course, is an unreasonable request.
He'd never get anything done.
He'd never get anything done. The Hut 3 headlines, famously, that we have in our archive are a response to this, because it was the job of Hut 3 to produce a manageable quantity of intelligence that would go to Churchill. And every morning he had a folder on his desk which contained Hut 3 headlines, naval headlines, and a thing called a blue jacket that was a folder of intelligence, diplomatic intelligence from the Foreign Office. And those three folders would be his kind of breakfast reading every day. He liked it from a policy point of view because he knew what was going on in the war, but he also liked to go into meetings knowing more than the people he was meeting. You know, his style as a politician was very much that way. So
never ask a question you don't really know the answer to.
Exactly. And he felt it very useful if he was having meetings with, you know, the First Sea Lord or the Chief of the General Staff or whatever, if he was privy to things that they didn't know, because some of these people weren't indoctrinated into ultra, so he could kind of go in there and trump them with facts that they weren't privy to. And the other problem was that he tended to take the stuff very literally. The problem with signals intelligence and all forms of intelligence is it has to be understood in quite a nuanced way and read against the background of the context in which it was created.
It's a jigsaw, isn't it?
It's a jigsaw.
Small piece.
And he tended to read things very literally. In North Africa, you have the problem that both Wavell and Auchinleck were very cautious about their plans against Rommel and the Germans. But because Churchill was reading Rommel's communications, and Rommel, when speaking to Berlin, always complained that he had no tanks and no men and no petrol and was about to lose, which, of course, all generals do. But Churchill took that literally and was going, well, Rommel's clearly on his uppers. Why haven't you beaten him yet? And actually, a more nuanced understanding of the intelligence would have been
better. It's very
better,
difficult to know where the line is, how much you tell the boss, isn't it?
Yes.
But there's a boss who clearly wanted to know everything. So at the time, he then produced this strident memo the next day. How did that go down at Bletchley Park? Or did nobody know about it? Did they just see the impact?
I haven't seen any documentation that shows the direct response to that memo. But it's undeniable that from that point on, the organisation starts to grow very rapidly. The huts that they're operating in 1940 are replaced in 1942 by the building of the blocks, which are much more substantial, can accommodate hugely more staff. And the graph of everything is massively upwards from beginning of 1942 onwards.
If people don't know the difference between those two types of buildings, it's staggering. you've got literally big garden sheds that weren't even on proper foundations, that it's more or less a miracle that they're still standing today. And you've got brick and concrete blocks that couldn't be demolished with great big wrecking balls in one case, and in which now you still can't get mobile phone reception.
They weren't quite bomb-proof in terms of being hit by a bomb, but they were built to be splinter-proof.
It represents a massive upsurge in investment, basically.
Oh, a huge, huge investment in personnel, equipment, buildings, everything else. And the site was basically a building site from that point on.
I know we're only talking about 60 members of staff, but resources still were very tight. Things were stretched very thin. You know, everyone was doing their bit somehow, even that early, would you say? Or am I getting an impression of perhaps later in the war then?
At that point, certainly the country is starting to get fully mobilised. You know, everybody who can is being taken into war employment. So, particularly for women, a lot of the women by that point would already be in war work. And conscription for women, forced conscription comes in 1942. So the country was definitely gearing up at that point.
Now, I wonder how much those four chaps realised the impact it had, because, of course, they wouldn't have seen Churchill's memo at that time.
Well, Stuart Miller-Barry talks about, he was obviously aware of the letter going off, and he knew nothing of Churchill's response until presumably when the official history came out in the 1980s, where the letter and Churchill's memo are reproduced as an appendix in the official history. And that's the first time they were kind of published to the nation, if you like. And it must have come as a surprise to him then. Gordon Welshman, I think, had, because he went on to write huge numbers of memos about huge numbers of things, had more or less forgotten about it. Because if you read Hutsick's story, he talks about his relationship with Travis and getting Travis to help him out with stuff, but he doesn't specifically reference the letter. He does talk about Churchill's visit and his recollections of that, but not the letter. In Hutsick's story, he talks about he'd written several memos to Travis earlier on, predicting what he thought the growth of the establishment would be, how many people they'd need, how many codes the Germans would be producing and everything else. Travis wasn't completely convinced, obviously, because the memo came back with balls written across it in brown fountain pen. So, which
Frank
was...
Frank exchange, then.
Travis's style. He wrote everything in brown fountain pen, apparently.
He was straightforward, forthright.
Yes, but Welshman did go on to say in the book, when I improved my arguments, Travis was convinced and moved with his characteristic speed and effectiveness. So he went back to him and refined the argument a bit and got what he wanted. Yes, he spent his days pestering for things. Wow, pestering the Prime Minister was probably not that slightly exceptional.
Yeah, he must have been a pest, but it worked, didn't it? Like you say, he probably was the chief instigator, given his form of writing, you know, we need this and this must be done type memos. But by Jove, it worked, didn't it? And he got all these others to sign up to it. It must have given them all quite a boost that they were listened to in that way.
I think so. I mean, the question is, they went back to work and then presumably some staff appeared, but that's probably the only feedback they got. Although actually, they must have known that it had caused some ructions, because according to Stuart Milner-Barry, Stuart Mingies, who was head of SIS at the time, reprimanded Welshman for, quote, having wasted 15 minutes of the Prime Minister's time. So that suggests that Churchill had gone to Mingies direct and said, I've had this letter from your chaps.
What's going on?
And Milner-Barry himself was also, Denniston on passing him sort of in the corridor, made a remark about his unorthodox methods. But he does say that Denniston was such a nice chap that he wouldn't have made a fuss about it anyway.
It's a classic tactic in organisations, isn't it, that people aren't getting the answer they want from the layer above them, so they'll go higher. But it's a really risky strategy, isn't it? Because you could just land yourself in such trouble.
Well, I think they were in a bit of a jam because they knew Travis was the man who was going to get stuff done. But everyone liked Denniston so much. He was such a nice man.
Sounds like he was a real raison d'etre, that he would, you know, deal with the difficult personalities brilliantly and some of the kind of troubled genius, maybe. That must have been quite a tricky thing to balance, because he's going to have young people with a lot on their shoulders to deal with. And maybe some slight, the word diva springs to mind. It's a very modern word, but there might have been a bit of that.
Well, I think Denniston earned his money just keeping Dilly Knox, you know, on the job. He presumably as well is coming from the pre-war, more old school GCNCS, when life was a little more genteel.
Well, Gordon Welchman was the agent of the industrialisation of it, wasn't he? So it all fits, doesn't it, as part of that, that he saw, he had this vision of how it needed to be done. And this was a big part of how it became that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
The President of the United States and the Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill, representing His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom, being met together, deem it right to make known certain common principles in the national policies of their respective countries, on which they base their hopes for a better future for the world. First, their countries seek no aggrandizement, territorial or other. Second, they desire to see no territorial changes that do not accord with the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned. Third, they respect the right of all peoples to choose the form of government under which they will live. And they wish to see sovereign rights and self-government restored to those who have been forcibly deprived of them. Fourth, they will endeavor with due respect for their existing obligations to further enjoyment by all states, great or small, victor or vanquished, of access on equal terms to the trade and to the raw materials of the world, which are needed for their economic prosperity. Fifth, they desire to bring about the fullest collaboration between all nations in the economic field, with the object of securing for all improved labor standards, economic advancement, and social security. Sixth, after the final destruction of Nazi tyranny, they hope to see established a peace that will afford to all nations the means of dwelling in safety within their own boundaries, and which will afford assurance that all the men in all the lands may live out their lives in freedom from fear and want. Seventh, such a peace should enable all men to traverse the high seas and oceans without hindrances. Eighth, they believe all the nations of the world, for realistic as well as spiritual reasons, must come to the abandonment of the use of force, since no future peace can be maintained if land, sea, or air armaments continue to be employed by nations which threaten, or may threaten, aggression outside their frontiers. They believe, pending the establishment of a wider and permanent system of general security, that the disarmament of such nations is essential. They will likewise aid and encourage all other practicable measures which will lighten for peace-loving peoples the crushing burden of armaments.
It's not one of the three things alone, is it? The visit, the letter, the memo. It's all of them together that made this huge turn in Bletchley Park's fortunes, sort of getting on for the middle of the war. It would make a massive difference to the way it was able to tackle the problem it was facing.
Very much so, yes. I mean, you have to remember that December 1941 is a crucial period in the Second World War. It's when the Americans finally enter the war. But I think you can see Churchill's response to the letter and the fact that he visits the site in September shows just how much he was getting behind the organisation, and he would from then on make sure that they got what they needed to do as much work as they could do. And the organisation grew as a consequence of that. So it's a key turning point in the history of Bletchley Park, I think.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.